morning. My name is Michael McCusker. A bitter partisan prelude to what is likely to be a truly uncivil war this election season takes place today in the U.S. Senate that very well might determine the direction of the Supreme Court for a generation or more, not to mention the possible fate of American democracy. The combatants are a male Supreme Court hopeful who is expected to provide a majority for overruling Roe versus Wade, the 1973 court decision that legalized abortion, and who might conceivably protect a president guilty of high crimes and treason. And a woman who has accused the Boy Scout posturing Supreme Court aspirant of attempted rape when both were teenagers. The intent of today's program is to add a few voices from not so long ago who have had much to say about women's rights and equality, and about one who was brutally silenced before she had a voice. I begin with that story, which I wrote, Girl on a Bicycle. A girl rides her bicycle to the beach, which she has done so often she hardly gives it a thought. Only this time she disappears and is never seen alive again. Her name was Doreen Ratterman. She was 15 that summer, 30 years ago in 1988, a high school student almost everyone in Gearhart, Oregon, knew and assumed they would see her every day for years yet, a girl with promise and a predictably long life ahead of her. Two young men were drinking beer on the beach and saw her on her bicycle. One of them, at least, got viciously horny. He raped and killed her. His companion claimed the man strangled her with a pocket watch chain. He was tracked to San Francisco, arrested, convicted, and died of AIDS in prison. It is a familiar horror, the murder and rape of a young girl. It happens all the time, but usually to other people in other places. But this time it happened on the Oregon coast in quiet Gearhart by the sea. An Oregonian editorial a few years later, after the murders of schoolgirls by two boys, rightly broadened the issue as, quote, a gruesome parody of a far too typical murder in the United States, the killing of a woman by an angry man, unquote. One of the most chilling aspects is that not only are victims increasingly younger, so are the killers, as are the male children who slaughter their schoolmates. Young girls are common prey for rapists, white slavers, sexual deviants, and murderers. Teenage runaways in particular, both boys and girls, routinely disappear, their remains often discovered in empty fields or trash dumpsters, identifiable only by age at death. The most vulnerable victims of violence and murder are women. They are usually assaulted for purposes of rape and frequently die in the course of it. There is a lie among men that women submit willingly to rape, or that it is impossible to rape a woman if she fights back. Contradictorily, it is suggested that a woman should be passive if a man is raping her, or she will be hurt, which, of course, would be her own fault for resisting. Men joke about rape. They call it assault with a friendly weapon. That kind of thinking gives the men who think that way the sense they can use their friendly weapons on any woman at any time or place, whether she likes it or not. The assumption is that women, all women, are subservient to all men. This idea is not limited to the Walter Mitty sort of men who deflect deep inferiority with lurid fantasies of machismo. Men who hate women, who are psychopathic in their contempt for women, promote the same opinion. These men make war on women. They batter, rape, and murder women. They use their muscle and social power to dominate women absolutely and crush them when they resist. They beat up their wives and girlfriends habitually, daughters also, and beat them again if they complain or seek help, and often, eventually, beat them to death. Some misogynists, men who hate women, start with murder. Serial killers are almost always men, and their victims are almost always women. Jack the Ripper cut out the insides of London prostitutes in 1888, a century before Doreen Ratterman rode her bicycle on the beach that fatal day. The Pacific Northwest has been fertile ground for such monsters. Ted Bundy from Washington, who raped and murdered college girls. The Green River Killer, who left bodies of young women scattered over the region. A Portland man who was caught murdering a prostitute as a final act of sexual frenzy. The battered corpses of earlier victims found buried around Malala. Other serial murderers of women claim they act under instructions of God. This savage insanity illuminates the ancient misogyny, the patriarchal gods at war against the feminine, the displacement of equality between women and men by a ruthless male dominance that presumes to remove women from history except as chattel. It has probably been the bitterest and longest war, thousands of years of wrathfully imposed male supremacy that shows little sign of winding down. Women who have fought back have been ostracized, imprisoned, and executed. Millions were burned to death as witches during medieval times in Europe, and afterward as late as the 17th century in New England. 19th century suffragists were often attacked and jailed. And although modern feminists have generally suffered less onerous oppression than their forebears, more verbal abuse and ridicule than physical assault, the problem of violent attacks by men against women is no less serious. Organizations to protect women from assault and battery have sprung up all over the USA, inspired not by official concern, but by battered women themselves. In the meantime, such infamous male sporting clubs as the 18th century Hellfire Club raped virgins for fun, while writers like the Marquis de Sade wrote books celebrating flagellation, the torture and sexual mistreatment of women. A few years ago, rumors of so-called snuff films, in which actresses in porno movies were murdered on camera, were never proven, but any film suspected of it was popular with S&M misogynist types. The rape of women is a reward and an incentive for armies, though in modern times it is denied or accused of an enemy. War is sometimes defined as armed men terrorizing women. Rape is not an act of passion. It is an act of aggression and degradation, an act of war. Nothing can satisfactorily explain the personal logic or motives of someone who attacks and murders. Humanity is a killing species, males in particular, the killer gender. We rule Earth because our ancestors were clever, ruthless, and well-organized predators, and we have always butchered our own as readily as any other creature. We kill individually, which is murder, or we organize murder and name it war. Soldiers rape and murder women and girls collectively. A man rapes and murders, or murders in the attempt of rape, a young girl on an isolated Oregon beach. There is a tendency in our fantasy-saturated society to be surprised by life, to recoil in shocked or numb horror when its hard realities leap out from the screens of our social media and strike at her flesh. Particularly in small communities, we mistake routine as safe because neither harm or horror has occurred in 1,000 repetitions of something we do or some places we go, and we assume it never will. Yet the pattern itself plays odds of its own making. People move into rural areas because they are sick and afraid of the crowded violence of cities and believe that geography will insulate them. It is commonplace to hear parents say they wish to raise their children in a safe environment, away from drugs, gangs, and sexual predators. It might be true that a small town is safer than a city, but it is not immune from the problems or dangers of any other place. A young girl rode her bicycle on a quiet beach one summer day 30 years ago and forfeited her life because she might have assumed life was safe, that a chance encounter with a stranger would not be fatal. Perhaps again, she was instantly aware of her peril, but was helpless to prevent the onrush of mortality. If she had been raped and murdered in a city, her death would almost be unnoticed. But in her small Oregon coast town, it was as if the town itself had been raped. And that was Girl on a Bicycle. Now I would like to read Womb Control by Deborah Cooper. Different reproductive roles represent the basic dichotomy of humankind. This difference has been used to rationalize all other ascribed differences and to justify woman's position as a second-class citizen, if she is considered a citizen at all. The idea of woman as nothing but a vessel has persisted throughout the centuries, with men making all the legal and moral decisions concerning reproduction. One indicator as to the amount of freedom allowed women has always been the amount of control we have been given over our reproductive functions, as evidenced by the availability of birth control and safe legal abortion. In early cultures, before the rise of patriarchy, procreation was not understood to be connected with coitus. Women, like the female deities these cultures worship, were thought to bring forth life alone and unaided. Women were highly respected for this and shared equal social and political power with men. At some point, a connection between coitus and procreation was made. This connection did not serve to enlighten both sexes, but instead became a major factor in the subjugation and oppression of women. The theory arose that life not only did not originate with women, but that in fact she had little or nothing to do with it. Semen was thought to contain the essence of life, and there was no notion of the part ova, eggs, play in the reproductive process. Women were reduced to the status of encapsulating amniotic sacs for the male's seed of life. Women were quickly made the legal property of men and their sexual activity limited to their owner to ensure paternity of the owner father. Women were chattel, no longer respected or revered. On the contrary, they were considered less than human, read male, and basically unclean menstruation, once celebrated as part of the natural cycle, came to be viewed as evidence of woman's inferiority. The rise of Judeo-Christianity echoed these themes and legitimized them. All women are said to pay for Eve's sinfulness with the curse of menstruation and the pain of childbirth. Mary, who is the holiest female figure in the Christian tradition, is little more than a vessel for God the Father's seed. Jesus is 100% God's son, Mary but a womb in which he resided for 9 months. In classical Rome and Greece, where although women were not completely equal, they were not chattel, birth control and abortion were widely available. A woman's body was considered her own and hers the right to choose whether she would or would not bear children. In contrast, punishment for abortion became so severe among Christians of the 11th century that the Holy Roman Emperor, Henry II, made it also a crime to miscarry, even unwillingly. The punishment was death by burning. Abortion has been a legal right of American women since the Supreme Court ruling, Roe v. Wade, in 1973, but the right and power to control our bodies has been under attack since. In 1981, the Senate, for example, voted to eliminate all federal funding for abortions where the woman's life was not endangered, which would have made it impossible for poor women to get abortions even if they were victims of rape or incest. The most powerful campaign to eliminate abortion has been the attempt to define the fetus as a person with all constitutional rights at the moment of conception. this simple definition made law would immediately outlaw all abortions and make any woman who had been guilty of premeditated murder. The penalty for this in some states is death. The death rate due to illegal abortions would be unprecedented. Because of fear of prosecution and the severity of the crime, very few skilled medical people would be willing to perform abortions. If a woman had complications after trying to abort herself, she would be turning herself in for murder by seeking medical care in time to save her life. If members of Congress, state legislatures, and other leaders of what should be more accurately called the pro-women's death movement, instead of right to life, have their way, even women whose lives are endangered by pregnancy or are suffering from a tubal pregnancy could be denied medical help. A plea of self-defense would not even be applicable, as this can be used only when the victim's conduct is wrongful and not in the case of a perfectly innocent fetus. And once again, as in the 11th century, women who miscarry could become liable for wrongful death. Our eating, sleeping, smoking, and drinking habits while pregnant could conceivably make us open to prosecution because of potential threat to the fetus, which would in effect have more rights than any woman alive. Many would argue that if women would be more responsible and use birth control, abortion would no longer be an issue. The fact is that as of yet, there is no 100% safe and effective form of birth control except celibacy. Even if there were, the so-called human life amendments and bills would outlaw the use, sale, or manufacture of contraceptives that prevent implantation of a fertilized egg, or in their definition, a person. The pill could be outlawed since it may work as an abortifacient. In a rare number of cases, the IUD would definitely be illegal and any woman using it a criminal. Celibacy or lesbianism would not make a woman free from the fear of an unwanted pregnancy, as every woman of childbearing age would still be subject to enduring a pregnancy as a result of rape or incest. Statistics show that victims of rape have a 17% chance of pregnancy and incest victims a 25% chance. Rape and incest have more than enough potential for damaging women's lives without the added horror of being forced to endure a 9-month and possibly lifetime, if they keep the child, reminder of their victimization. The last few decades have seen more and more women questioning patriarchal thought and practice. The movement for female emancipation has become broad and widespread. Now, just when many of us accept as fact that women are men's equals and deserve the same right of control over our lives and have left the battleground to tend to our personal growth, we face a backlash movement which has the very real and present potential of investing the state, read patriarchy, with a more destructive and thorough control over our bodies and lives than has heretofore been imagined. The myth of woman as but a vessel for male seed would not only be socialized, it would be legalized. This movement, ironically, calls itself Right to Life, or pro-life, to which we may well ask, whose life? So-called right to life forces have generally opposed the kinds of programs which would make abortion less frequent, childcare, sex education, contraception, and so forth, while backing military spending, nuclear energy, and the industrial rape of the earth in the name of profit and national security. It is telling that these people who are supposedly pro-life are so concerned with the survival of an insentient mass of cells and accept war, a ritualized, institutionalized form of mass murder, as normal, even justified human behavior. If they were to put the same money, time, and energy to ending war, there might be more hope for this planet. Many think that abortion could never be outlawed. They should think again. Throughout history, laws and opinions regarding birth control and abortions have fluctuated, not on the basis of reproductive control as women's right, but according to the cultural climates of Puritanism, so-called sexual liberation, or the requirements of military aggression and the labor market. This country has taken a swing to the right, and although the majority still favors legalized, safe abortion, a very powerful minority realizes that the most effective way to squelch women's drive for equality is to take away our right to control our own bodies. Without the full capacity to limit our own reproduction, other freedoms and rights, and those were in quotes, are but tantalizing mockeries that could not be exercised. We must not take our present rights for granted, but fight to keep them. There is no time for complacency. Not only our freedom, but our very lives are at stake. And that was Womb Control by Deborah Cooper, who originally wrote this for the North Coast Times Eagle in 1979. Under her favorite nom de plume, Iris Wilde. She now lives in San Francisco. And now, Violence Against Women by Margaret Frimuth. The fear of male violence is bred into woman's very souls. It is the fear of being harassed, beaten, threatened, and kidnapped, of being raped, of being tortured and treated as less than human, and then killed at the hands of male power. The single most common fear of women is being violated by a man she does not know, the stranger rape, the mugger, the burglar. However, women are constantly surrounded by many forms of male violence. It is in our homes and in our relationships. Our stories are in the newspapers. We hear it in popular music. We are shown violence to women and children in advertising and on TV shows and the movies. Still, we fear the stranger more than we recognize the violence that threatens us every day. Women are trained to be conflicted about these fears. We are simultaneously taught to fear men because of their greater physical strength and to rely on men as our benevolent protectors. Most of us learn to minimize our fears. When we discuss the intuitive dangers around us and our terrors of walking alone at night or the subtle threats that come from male peers, we are often categorized as oversensitive or hysterical. When we find ourselves in abusive relationships, we are told we love too much. When we reject the blaming and focus on the acts of male violence as the problem, we are targeted as angry women and men haters. And most importantly, we have been taught to fear the targeting more than the physical dangers, so that when one woman is targeted, other women learn to step away and remain silent. Their silence is seeped in fear. Historically, women who have been models of strength, outspoken and verbal about the abuses around them, have been publicly ridiculed and socially chastised. Many women are beaten when they speak out. No less than 3 million women were burned as witches. Male violence and the fear of violent male retaliation has effectively hidden these truths behind the guise of male protection. Individual violence is also systemic violence. Women and children fall prey to both these violences. If I were granted the power to eliminate all the violence done by women to men and children, would there still be violence in the world? Yes, indeed. If I could eliminate all the violence done by men to women and children, would there still be violence in the world? Yes, probably. But this thought calms me more than the previous question. If men were held accountable for acts of violence, neither individual nor systemic acts would be socially tolerated. I am weary of being assigned to the role of caretaker based on my gender. I am exhausted from caring for women and children without substantial financial stability. Perhaps men could hold themselves accountable by passing a restitution tax, subject to all men based on the premise that men are the predominant violators of women and children. Money from this tax could fund women's crisis services and child abuse centers. Crazy? Radical? Perhaps. But the thought brings to mind a more peaceable kingdom. perhaps it is time for outrageous responses to the outrageous acts of violence. And that was by Margaret Smith, Violence Against Women. She is a former director of the Clatsop County Women's Crisis Service and director of VOCA, Victory Over Child Abuse Camp. This article was written for the North Coast Times-Eagle, and she wrote it in 1989. And now a poem by Monica Koski, Because You Are a Man. Because you are a man, because the night edges over my eyes, because you walk behind me, I wait for your knife to skim my skin, to carve a wall in my flesh that my intestines slop through, uncoiling themselves to the cement. Because you are a man behind me at night, I, grateful for the streetlight, watch your shadow on the snow, check your gait, make sure it will not grow long onto mine. Make sure your arms do not lift me to a lonely lot. Your tongue does not push past my teeth. Your voice does not sound in my ear and in my mind that does not forget. Because there are men at night, I ask men to walk me home. And that was Because You Are a Man by Monica Koski. And she was a senior at Jefferson High School in Portland when she wrote this poem in 1986. And as epilogue for this program, amid the furor and fury of this latest Supreme Court nomination, this past Monday's 289th birthday of the Supreme Court itself, which was established September 24th, 1789, seems to have passed unnoticed. And it might also be seemly to mention that on the following date, September 25th, 1981, 192 years later, that Sandra Day O'Connor was sworn in as the first woman justice of the Supreme Court. This is Michael McCusker. I dedicate this program to Dr. Christine Blaisley Ford, and to Lee Ann Jones Kelly, who was the founder of the original Clatsop County Women's Crisis Service 39 years ago in October 1979.